And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. And our speaker tonight is Miss Judy, and I've known her for a very, very long time, and I love her, and she always makes me laugh and smile and has helped me through a few problems that I've had in the past, and I can't wait to hear her story. I know it's going to be excellent. So with that, I'll give you Judy.
Thank you, Judy. Well, let's see who this is. Hi, everybody. My name is Judy, and I am an alcoholic. Hi. And my sobriety date is January 16th, 1996. So I almost have, well, I have 15 and a quarter years. But a lot has changed because I'm more comfortable in my own skin, and I have a little bit more clarity about my identity. But my ego still comes up, and I was thinking yesterday after I left the meditation meeting at Triangle, hey, I could go to Lenox and buy myself a nice suit. And then I would show everybody that we alkies clean up magnificently. But the thing is, I hate high heels and I hate pantyhose. And the first time I ever gave a talk in grade school, and I was wearing a skirt, my underpants fell down. So that I prefer slacks. So also, I have my favorite boots. The higher power gave me a cool evening, so take a look. Because as I was growing up, everyone used to tell me, oh, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And actually, I tried, and it doesn't work. So I will tell you that I have been a performer for almost 66 years. My father died just before my fifth birthday, and it was such a shock that I truly kind of took in a sharp intake of breath, and people, when I was in rehab or getting help, used to tell me, breathe, because I didn't. I had this very shallow breathing. So, since I have learned more and more about the processes that create someone like myself, an alcoholic and a codependent and a phony, myself went into hiding at that time because I wasn't allowed to cry. And since I've learned in this program that pain and suffering are very democratic, I used to think, why me, you know, nobody knows the trouble I've seen, and now I know. I do, and I have such compassion for anybody who comes and honestly, honestly wants to change their way of living, because most of us have wounds that we haven't shown to other people, and we've carried rather bravely. So I'll chronicle my early untreated wounds as quickly as possible, so that I'm going to then pause and have some of you, or all of you, I'd like you to think about the repercussions that might occur later in life to someone who's had untreated wounds from childhood. I'm sure you'll have a better idea than my psychiatrist did. So I'll go with the first bang. I was born in 1939. I'm Jewish, and it was during the Holocaust. Now, I was lucky. My family had emigrated to Wheeling, West Virginia. And most of the family I had there were trying to bring their relatives to the United States. And the history is very kind of tragic, because Roosevelt, although he wrote, I have a letter from him to my father, congratulating Gad on starting a synagogue in a small town, but he refused to let a ship that was carrying Nazis, fleeing Jews, to come here. So the stress that was going on with my family, I was just a little girl, and I had no idea. I just knew. I loved my mother, I loved my father, and there was a loving group around us. And more than anything, I loved the woods here because in Wheeling, West Virginia, it's kind of Appalachia. We lived on a hill surrounded by trees, and as an alcoholic in training, I used to love to take dares, and they'd say, I bet you can't take that vine and swing across that cliff. And I'd say, you want to bet? So that was kind of an idyllic life. But one morning, I'll tell you a little bit more about that morning, but then, bang, my aunt who lived down the street died in childbirth. And her daughter, my cousin, she handled her mother quest better than I handled my father quest. She's become a Jungian analyst, and she lives in California, and I became an alcoholic. But I think I'm happier than she is. First of all, alcohol, I love alcoholics because we know kind of for a while how to escape. And poor Al-Anons and the ones who don't escape, you know, have to deal with life on life's terms, and that was never my strong suit. So then, another bang. We had to leave our home in the hills and move to New York City. Well, for country kids who just felt at home in this surrounding, to live in Manhattan, where the playgrounds were concrete, and half the time you can't see the sky because of the skyscrapers. They literally make you feel like you're in twilight because they cast these long shadows. So my brother and I were not happy in New York, but we moved there to be near my mother's favorite brother and her family. She was a New Yorker. And then, bang, the uncle we had moved to be near got very, very sick. And this kid got on her knees and said, oh, God, please don't take Uncle Eddie, or I will never believe in you again. Big threat. And Uncle Eddie died. And I said, oh, no. I was only kidding, God. I was only kidding. So you have bang, bang, bang. We moved to the suburbs so that we could, after Armistice Day, World War I, thank God, was over. And there were trees in our yard. But it's kind of hard for, I started first grade, I had kindergarten in New York, and I come home from school, a 35-year-old man grabbed me, dragged me into a garage, and raped me. Now, he's 35 and I am 6. So, I mean, I could break down right now, but to have been a performer all those years and be smiling, and we know that what that smile means, you know, I'm fine, fucked up, insecure, neurotic, and emotional, I'm absolutely fine, but my mother could not handle my tears because obviously, I have been in gated communities called mental hospitals, and they wanted to know about my family of origin. And my mother was 89 when she died, but she had a living friend who gave me such a wonderful story of my mother's life, because often we're victims of victims. I had no idea what her childhood was because she's my mother, and you know, she's all-knowing. But she obviously, here she lost family in Europe, she lost relatives here, and she had 2 brats to raise. And she used to say, when men dated her and they met us, they flew away. But that, I mean, I can just imagine what that was for her. And my brother was a rageaholic. And the day Dad died, we came downstairs. This is an important thing that I'm going to tell you because it set a stage for my lifelong behavior. Mother felt, my Jewish mother, that if we eat, eat, my child, eat. Then you'll be able to handle whatever comes. So she and my uncle, my father's brother, were sitting at the breakfast table, and they had set a party table. They obviously wanted us to be in some kind of altered sense before we got the news. I don't know what they could have been thinking. I never checked that out. But our orange juice was in crystal goblets, and we had beautiful plates with French toast sprinkled with powdered sugar. We thought we were going to have a party. And my brother says, "Where is Dad?" And Mother said, "That's what I have to tell you, kids. He died last night." "Why didn't you tell me right away?" "I hate you. I loved my father. I hate you." And the next thing I hear is the crystal goblet being shattered against the sidewalk, and my brother raging down the street. And I felt empty inside, absolutely empty, and I started to wail, and my mother put her hands on my wooden shoulders and pointed me toward the door, and she said, "Don't cry, honey. It's a beautiful day. Go out and play." So I actually followed her directions because something inside me told me it was very important now for me to support my mother. And I lay on the grass, and that's when the good fortune of a nature lover, I think I was a mystic, because it was a fall day. Another part of this is if higher power wrote it, it was the fall solstice, equal light and dark. And I was heading into the dark, but there were apples on the ground, and there were seeds that had fallen as well as dead leaves. And I could see life, death, and rebirth. I saw it, and I'm only a child, but in that moment, I kind of saw that amazing cycle. So nature has always been my nurse, my teacher, and often my mother. And after that, guess what? The next day, my cousin who'd lost her mom and her sister and my brother and I were taken to see Bambi. Now, isn't that a good movie? Because Bambi's mother is killed. And there we are. But that's another template. Because if you've seen Bambi, here's this little innocent fawn and the... Well, the hunters shoot, and of course the mother tries to save Bambi. He scampers, "Run, run, Bambi, run." And Bambi says, "Mom, we made it." But you hear the shot, and you know Mom didn't. So, of course, the next thing Disney does is you cut from the one tear, and then you're in la la, ta la 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 la. It's springtime, and Thumper and Flower and all the little animals are falling in love. And I think that's a diagnosis of mine. I became terminally Twitter-pated. But they don't have that in the DSM-4. So Twitter pation was my kind of defense mechanism, because la, 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 people would say, "Where's your dad?" "It's the father-daughter dinner." And I say, "Oh, he expired like a traffic meter." Now, it wasn't really funny, but I was a kid who read the dictionary. I would read the encyclopedia too. They were at the foot of my bed. I'd look up a word, and 4 hours later, I'd still be reading the dictionary. But the encyclopedia was fabulous because I would get diseases I read about when I hadn't done my homework. I would have these amazing symptoms. And I remember once my mother calling the doctor, and he said, "That's very strange. Sounds like she has beriberi." But I had so many diseases, you don't get me in United States. But anyway, my mother played along, which was not good for my ability to take life on life's terms. As a matter of fact, when I was a teenager, thank you for sharing, when I got my period, she gave me opium. So I loved my moon time. I just thought, oh, this is this grand. I just sailed through it, and I did not have to go to PE. Of course, I couldn't walk. It was wonderful. So, do you see a vague set up for an alcoholic? Just vague. So, anyway, after the years of molestation by the man who raped me, his teenage nephews, we were told, because social workers came in, nobody helped me emotionally, they didn't in those days, but it turned out, they said he had shell shock in World War II, today we call it PTSD, but shell shock was what it was called, and I kind of felt bad that he was taken to a mental hospital, because then I imagined snake pits, and God only knows how lucky we are today that instead of snake pits, they're pits for checks and dollars. But the sense that I had somehow caused this, and then they found out his nephews were children of incest, and they were sent to foster homes. So at this point, I just want you to think for a minute. A sensitive, artistic girl who's now maybe 7 or 8, who feels she's damaged goods, smiling all the time, what might be some of her emotions? I'm sure you can imagine. I'm just going to name a few that you might recognize. How about overwhelmed, helpless, vulnerable, frightened, confused? Do any of those words come to mind? And how do you know that on the most beautiful day, everything isn't going to drop out from under your feet? You just have no idea. So I now know words, then I didn't, that I became obsessive compulsive to try to control things. And my control mechanism was every light switch in the house. Now, we had one light switch that had 3 switches and one upstairs that had 1. It was very complicated getting them all in order. It's amazing I ever got to bed. But that gave me a sense of control of something. And, you know, you don't step on a crack, you might break your mother's back. So, you know, as I say, my mother had to stay in control. And I have a feeling if she let loose with her emotions, with all, she was the matriarch of the family too, that she wouldn't have been able to be responsible. So, I'm going to leave this sketch of my formative experiences and take you into my context. Most of you have seen some of the shows of the 50s, Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best. Well, I thought Leave It to Beaver was a reality show. And so, the magazines and our textbooks, too. Our textbooks told us that boys were the doers and the girls watched. In the dictionary, the word is microscope. There is the young boy looking through the eyepiece and the little girl standing in her full skirt and puffy sleeves, clapping. And when you saw your textbooks, which ours was Dick and Jane, and they were blonde and blue-eyed, and Mom wore a full skirt, stockings, and high heels to mop the floor. And she cooked in, you know, cocktail dress. And Dad came home, and he was in a fedora and his gray flannel suit. And we thought this was the world. And girls, this was before the birth control pill, and we didn't have sex before marriage, and we actually believed in some of the propaganda, because after the war, in order to keep the economy going, we were used, because women are great purchasing agents, to buy appliances, because appliances keep the wheels of industry turning. So we were sold on living in suburbia. There we were, behind our little picket fences, married young, and competing with the Joneses for new dishwasher. Oh my God, the Joneses have a newer one. Now this is dreadful, and it was important to live in a lemon fresh house. Now while this is happening, Betty Friedan is doing some research, and she found, surprise, surprise, behind the picket fences, most of us women were smashed, because it wasn't exactly what we expected after going to college, that we would be cleaning diapers and making certain our mothers-in-law could see their faces in our shining dishware. So Valium was then the medication of the day. Now, I'm going to actually read you two pieces, because they are so indicative. As I told you, I worked at the women's magazines, and we had these giant double-page spreads of gorgeous dinners, because that's the way to get to your man through his stomach. If you give him a good dinner, he might actually buy you a refrigerator. So, we were taught to look good. So this is an ad. It was in McCall's magazine, the magazine I work for. And it's how tension makes you feel. Now, ladies, listen to this. Ever think how it makes you look? No one need tell you how you feel when tension holds you fast, you know. In the pit of your stomach, you know. But do you sense at such a time an equally unpleasant change come over you? It's the way you look. It's the strained expression you exhibit to everyone you meet. Engrossed with the wretched way you feel, you're understandably not aware of the unhappy change in your facial appearance. Gone is the smoothness of your skin. In its place, detention lines are etched. Your eyes wear that anxious, fretful-looking, yet not seeing stare. Not a pretty sight indeed. To calm yourself quickly from the effects of simple nervousness, to help maintain your natural cosmetic appeal, take Alva Tranquil. You'll relax fast, look better fast, before tension has time to wreak havoc on your face. Available without prescription at drug counters. So there it is. It doesn't matter how you feel, it's how you look. Then we had a very popular songwriter. His name was Burt Bacharach. I don't know whether any of you know his music. He would be tarred and feathered today. I took down the lyrics of one of his songs. It was called Wives and Lovers. Hey, little girl, comb your hair. Fix your makeup. Soon he will open the door. Don't think, because there's a ring on your finger you needn't try anymore. For wives should always be lovers too. Run to his arms the moment he comes home to you. I'm warning you. Day after day there are girls at the office, and men will always be men. Don't think him off with your hair still in curlers. You may not see him again. I don't think I have to finish this, but you can Google it. And actually, it was very popular. So our songs were songs of, hey, little girl, or codependence. I can't live without you. I mean, we were absolutely to be enmeshed. So that's my context. And it had a tremendous effect on my sense of capability. And I felt that I had this learned helplessness that a lot of women had, that I couldn't exert power for my own choices. I went to college, as many women of my era did. 2 years later, it changed to get a man. That was the idea. I went to a good school, and I met him. He was head of his class at MIT, and actually, my mother met him. She just thought, oh, this is the one for my daughter, because he was brilliant. And he was gaga about me, but he didn't want to wait for me to continue my career, and mother didn't want me to lose this great opportunity, because his father was a surgeon, and his mother would have been a businesswoman today, but she was a volunteer then. And we married, and it was good for several years. But he got his doctorate at Berkeley. And have you heard of Berkeley in the 60s, anyone? Raise your hand. Well, there you go. It was what you heard. The smell of patchouli is probably still on me. Drugs, sex, and rock and roll. And you see, that was the most amazing time because everything collided. The birth control pill had just been developed. We were in an unpopular war in Vietnam. And there were no sexually serious diseases. Anything could be treated with penicillin. We were far away from our families. We were, you know, so Aunt Susan wasn't saying, what would your mother think? So we were pretty anonymous, and then it wasn't a great idea to be anonymous. But while my husband was getting his doctorate, I was a children's textbook editor in San Francisco, which I loved. But he was studying the girls who were wearing see-through blouses. And he joined something called the Sexual Freedom League. Well, that was very educational, I must say, that I thought we were going to a Stanford professor's home for an evening of intellectual discourse. We arrive at their gated mansion, and I noticed that at their Olympic-sized swimming pool, nobody was wearing clothes. So my gap again, and my husband said, honey, I'm just here because I'm curious. You know, we don't have to do anything. But someone gave me some punch, and it had some punch. I had an eye rush, and I was guided into a room where there were mattresses and the bongo drums are playing. And I am a good alcoholic in training, and I looked at my husband and I said, I am so mad at you, I'm going to hurt me. So I figured, with this strange sensation coursing through my body from whatever I drank, I might not act in my own best interest. And as the evening went on, that proved to be true. So years actually went by because I seemed to be powerless against my husband. My mother didn't want me to get divorced. His brilliance and his future, at a time when Sputnik was showing the United States that technology, we just better move ahead. And here he is now top at Berkeley, and he gets a postdoc in Paris. So I became a extraterrestrial. I could dissociate, and I would go to these occasions and pretend that I was a being from another planet studying humans. It was kind of an alien anthropologist. So I took notes, and do I have notes? I have more than the library at Berkeley, because this whole thing was so strange. I have to look at the time. Anyone afterwards could ask me, because it was very well organized. Monday, lewd food, Tuesday, jam sessions. Of course, the model is covered with jam. And then you have visual delights and sensoriums. I mean, very, very unusual. And I wasn't even an alcoholic yet, but I did drink in order to go to sleep because I no longer felt valued or cherished. I'm sure any woman can understand that perhaps it's different for men, but we produce a hormone for bonding, and it's not nice. to fool Mother Nature. No, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. So I actually was no longer even friends with my husband, though I supported him as much as a wife could. And we spent the next year in France, which was wonderful for me because, again, I'm a performer and I went to cooking school and art school because I'm a painter and I love learning how to cook. But we ended up in the middle of the Illinois prairie where he took a job as a professor. Now, that was the other side of the moon for me. There are no hills, no trees, no water. I said, Chuck, I can't stay here for the weekend. It's too depressing. February in Illinois, the sky is leaden and it presses down on the earth like a window shade and there's just a crack of light across the horizon. It didn't bode well that my favorite place was a cemetery because it had trees and it had a hill. But we lived there for 22 years. I had a girl and a boy, and we looked like the all-American family because we had a spotted Springer Spaniel. So there we were, the girl and the boy and the dog named Spot. But now what? The kids didn't need me anymore. I did get a couple of more university degrees, but there was no way to use them. So, clever. I'm going to write a book. I will synthesize the world of the women's magazines and Home and Hearth with the Sexual Freedom League. That's what I'm going to do. So I wrote a book called The Kitchen Kama Sutra. And it was actually wonderful. It was amazingly clever because if anyone has bought detergent, you will see names like Joy, Fantastic, and you think, I don't get that turned on my hygiene. So I began mixing massage oils and putting that in the Joy bottle because I thought that's real truth in advertising. So I really came up with a wonderful book, and it was purchased by a company in New York, but they called it The Joy Around You. And when The Joy Around You came out, I realized there was no joy inside Judy. And I lived in a small town, and in a small town, an author becomes kind of a celebrity. And so it was very embarrassing that I had to go see a shrink for depression when I was the joy lady. But I did make enough money on The Joy Around Me, around you, to go to a mental hospital for that depression. So my life is so full of paradox, and that actually came after my mother died. My kids actually were already, I think, well, certainly out of college, and boy, my son this weekend is celebrating his 20th wedding anniversary. So I knew I couldn't fake that smile anymore. I couldn't. It was just so brittle. You know, I was going to fall on the floor and cut my foot. So I saw somebody in St. Louis whom I loved, and she understood what was going on and introduced me to a good psychiatrist. I don't have enough time to speak. Yeah, I'll quick fit in what happened in the Illinois psychiatrist, because the first one I saw, being the performer, I was so ashamed of going to see a psychiatrist that I leaned forward and looked at him piercingly and said, "What made you go into this field?" So I listened and learned that if his mother hadn't sold the farm, he would have been wildly rich because developers would have had it and he wouldn't have to sit in a windowless room listening to people's troubles. So he did tell me when I left, "You look pretty good. Be of good cheer." The next person I met was a neurosurgeon that I knew, and he said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm really having trouble." And he said, "Come into my office." Well, after he listened, at least, and then he said, "I know what you need. You need an affair." So I thought, oh my God, if I needed that, you know, what? Then I said, "This is serious. This is really serious." So he called a New York, a guy who just come in from New York, and I, New Yorker, yeah, that's good, they'll know what to do. So I saw him the next day, and he had read about my book, and he'd seen my art shows, and he said, Judy, why can't you just be happy to be a big frog in a little pond? That's what I'm doing. And after $300 and three meetings, I discovered the solution, a cheery, promiscuous amphibian. So, armed with this advice, I went to see a psychopharmacologist, and then I became a walking side effect. Years of careening into the wall took me to this woman in St. Louis who asked me about my childhood. Nobody else had, and she suggested that I go to the place where she got trained, and that was Menninger Clinic, and just for a consult. I go there, and they hear my story, and that I've been on Valium PRN, which means I could take it whenever I wanted, for 12 years. And benzodiazepines are hard to come off of. So I had to be inpatient for 2 months, and I did have a brain aneurysm. So what I learned there, though, was a bit of cracking through my denial. And also, they told me that I would be in a unit with some very bright people, and I was there with some people you would know and from politics and television. But I thought, yeah, when I was in high school, I wasn't exactly looking forward to being the Phi Beta Kappa of the mentally ill. So, as I say, there were bright people, but you could cut the pain. You could cut the pain. I mean, desire for death was strong. So at the end of my stay there, my husband had to come also for visits. They said, you know, it's not going to be easy for you. You're moving to Atlanta. You don't know anybody. Your husband is difficult. What are you going to do? And I said, oh, I'll just drink. He said, uh-oh, you better see a video. So I saw a video on alcoholism, and I realized, yes, I had become an alcoholic. I needed alcohol as a boost to my psychiatric drugs. And my ex-husband, he's obviously a heavy drinker and not an alcoholic, because he still functions at a high, high level. But he can drink 8 ounces of scotch every night to go to sleep and take Desiree or something. So once I understood and I knew too much, I knew we'd have to get divorced. And we did once we were here in Atlanta. So what would a girl who is told go out and play when she finds her beloved father is dead, when she's really alone for the first time in a new town, doesn't have a home, doesn't know anybody? Yes, I went out to play. Now, for me to play meant I was going to become a goddess. And I think all of you know that goddesses have long hair. So I needed a wig. And I got a fall and attached it to my own short hair. And I thought it looked fabulous. I've seen pictures of me. And the hair didn't match. But heck, I thought it was fabulous. And I come off to Paris because this young lady, who's a dear friend of mine, has an apartment in a great section of Paris. And I had it free just to water her plants. So my wig and I parade in Paris for 2 months. And as HP would have it, I met a British businessman in AA, because I was going to AA, and he had a silver lotus expert, and we lived together for the 2 months, and my wig didn't bug him. So I decided this goddess thing was great, because we would speed along the Champs-Élysées, and my wig flying, hanging onto my head, but still the hair, the acrylic flying out behind me, and the gendarmes would bow. This car was remarkable. But at the end of the summer came my initiation by fire, because I had to go back to Atlanta. Now, I was living one day at a time, which is good when you're in the program, but not when you're in La La Land. So I tried not to think of the day I was leaving Roy and the capital of Paris, and went to an invitation at the couple we had known, my ex and I, when he was doing his postdoc. Now, Philippe had made a pass at me about 30 years earlier because he's French, and French do French kissing. So, just to prove who they are. And his wife was not too pleased that I was getting divorced. She said, you know, it's not a funny thing, a woman of a certain age, to be alone. Well, now, I'm a goddess, and I have a lot to prove. So, I lotion and potion myself at a boutique, and I take the metro to their apartment. But on the metro, the French smoke. Galois, Gitan, and I'm smelling the fumes, but I'm high on my own fumes. So, I got off of the train, and I'm walking to their apartment, but one of the Algerian workmen is following me, and he's winking and waving, and I'm thinking, he cannot help himself, I am a goddess. Oh, how out there I was. So, I was happy, though, to get to their apartment and press the numeric code and get inside the lobby, because I was actually getting a little nervous, and I take the elevator, get up to Philippe and Anne-Marie's apartment, hoping Philippe would open the door, because my motives were still lousy, and it was Anne-Marie. Philippe wasn't home, but she gave me the look I was hoping for, and she said, Judith, tes cheveux, Judith, your hair. And I said, do you like it? She said, it's on fire. That guy had flicked a cigarette, and those acrylic fibers were beginning to curl and have little embers on the ends and start to go into flame. So, I should have said I'm a flaming redhead, but I whipped it off my head and threw it in their toilet. So when Philippe came home, my own naturally curly, you know, sweaty hair was plastered to my head, and I looked like the rat I was. So as they say, sometimes you don't see the light until you feel the heat. But I had to go back to Atlanta the next day, and without my wig, and without a plan. So, quickly, of course, I used AA, but not the way we do it now. Not the way at all. I didn't do any of the steps. I didn't tell people that I was frightened. I didn't think anyone would help me unless I paid them. So, my therapist was out of the country. And what I did, I put on my answering machine, I have gone on a spiritual retreat and will be home in 10 days. I went to the liquor store and got 6 gallons of gin, cheap gin, and went on a retreat with spirits and almost didn't come back. But somebody from the 11:30 meeting, my brother's in the program, he has more time than I, and he was worried that I'd come home, right home from Paris, and go on a spiritual retreat, right? So he also knew his sister. So he called Naba, and thank goodness there are people who know how to break into houses, and they found me in alcoholic coma. And so I'll fast forward to the moment I came back to this wonderful clubhouse. And then some of you will remember the downstairs, the kitchen served, I think, lunch. And I could stay here all day because I still didn't trust me. I was still the sweetest little murderer you'd ever want to meet, because I'd look at myself and say, what are you going to do to yourself today? I didn't trust myself. But I trusted the rooms. And I very carefully structured my days, had a sponsor, and I have to tell any of you who don't have that much time, I am certainly one who didn't take to this naturally, but once I did surrender and I let all resistance go, we will kind of quickly go through the steps if I brought them up here, because that is so important. But I'll just, you can look at them. One, I certainly knew I was alcoholic. My life was unmanageable. And I knew that not only was it unmanageable, I could die. I could die. I knew no, but I couldn't pretend anymore it could happen to someone else. I knew that it was chronic. It was, it it gets worse, and it's fatal. You either, you know, sober up, get locked up, or get covered up. And I'm so glad it's not the last for me. But I did come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. But that power was good orderly direction, because the Old Testament God had smited my nation. I was really frightened. Uncles, aunts, people dying. So it wasn't cozy for me to cuddle up. Then three, turned my will and my life over to the care of that higher power as I understood. And because it was good orderly direction, that became my path. And that also meant I was going to do the rest of the steps. So because I now knew I was the problem, I saw all my patterns, and my sponsor could too, because familiar with people pleasing, with fear, and anything to reduce anxiety, anything, even if it was momentary. So I could see that, and then because I shared it, and then six and seven, I no longer was comfortable with my character defects. I wanted them removed, the lying, the pretending I'm not good enough, or the feeling I'm not good enough, because I said, God, if I'm your daughter, I'm good enough for anyone. And I learned not to compare myself to anyone else, just to me, when I came in or crawled in. And so even my adrenaline rush that I get from being late, I've tried to get over, because there's something about an adrenaline rush I still kind of enjoy. But I'm getting better. And then making, you know, willing to make amends. And on that ninth step, I'll just share, I have an uncle who lived to almost 102. He didn't invite me to his 101st birthday because I had acted out at his 100th birthday. And I was resentful. I was not going to speak to him. When I'd had enough program, I thought, what? He's your uncle. He's your mother's brother. Please make amends. You know, all I had wanted at his party was to take pictures, but he didn't want it. So I called him and I said, you know, I've been missing you. And he said, oh, Judy, I miss you too, and I love you. And then he said, you know, I'm tired. I'll call you back later, okay? And I said, okay. He said, I'm going to take a nap. He died right after we hung up. And I do not have unfinished business. So think of that, you know, with the ninth step. And then the tenth step is so good every day to take an inventory, because I can see things I do well, too. And if I'm on time, I say, hiya, girl. I'm nice to myself. If I'm clumsy, I don't say, you clumsy girl. I say, well, you sweet old darling. You know, are you tired? You know, but I've learned to be nice to myself. I used to just say the worst things. So the 11th step has also become precious. As I said, I'm Jewish, but the Old Testament God isn't—he's cranky. So I won't tell you. I always wanted him to have a goddess. I figured if she were there on Sabbath, he wouldn't have been so cranky with the first people. But that, as it may be, I did develop a consciousness that is so beautiful of a force for good in the universe. And when I align myself with that force, invisible hands seem to open doors. But when I go against it, I might get through those doors. But on the other side, I'll trip. Something will happen. So that knowledge of how that intuitive sense that I get through prayer and meditation, and I do Sabbath, Friday night at sundown to Saturday night, Mark knows that, I call God Daddy, and I say, Daddy, can I hang out with you? And Daddy, will you tell me a story? And I have written children's stories that are gorgeous, that have, I swear, they've channeled, and they're good. And that time when I could never be alone with myself, now I have 24 hours that are non-negotiable, and they're gorgeous. And then, of course, the 12th step, that is the joy of the program, that our darkest times in God's hands can be transformed to help someone else. Today, I'm not just a problem person. I can also be a solution person. So I'm going to close with the fact that I don't need to have the cranky Old Testament God. I have more the Jewish humorous God like Seinfeld or Jack Benny, but particularly Mel Brooks. And he put my hair on fire, I'm sure, with Blazing Saddles. So he has a saying that I love, and he said, if God had wanted us to fly, he'd have given us tickets. So I will say, if God had wanted us to be happy, joyous, and free, he would have given us AA, and he did. Thank you.
Miss Judy, for a great story. We're going to pass the baskets one more time for anybody who came in late. And I have asked Frank to give out the chips, please.
I'm Frank Waters, I'm a recovered alcoholic. And the blue chip speaker beaten, they have the same chips everybody else has in heaven. They have a white chip for people who want to try this way of living without a drink, one minute at a time, one day at a time. If you tried it before and you're coming back, same chip. Does anybody here tonight want to pick up a white chip? Try this one day at a time, 1 hour at a time. Okay. Anybody have 30 days for a silver chip? Fine. Have a red for 90 days. Anybody have 90 days? Okay. Yellow chip for 6 months. Green chip for 9 months. Does anybody need a pickle chip? How about a blue chip for years and multiples of years?
This is Mark. It's his birthday. And Mark's the first person, and I don't even like the word sponsor particularly, but he's the first person that ever asked me to be a sponsor. This is, been doing this a long time. Bob Meadows introduced us. And, you know, he is an amazing guy. I've seen him go through so much. He really, I mean this, he does it still a whole lot better. And he has helped me a whole lot more than I know I've helped him. He has let me hang around and be his friend, and it is an honor to give him his 8-year chip.
Hey, Tim. My name is Mark. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Mark.
8 years.
Yeah.
Thank you, Judy. I've heard your story before. I'm glad they broke in your house and got you. I, 48 years, I've been around this clubhouse quite a long time, and I know people that died, and that kind of touched my heart. And, almost died of drugs and alcohol. Almost been a statistic. So it wasn't going to be no more. Oops. I'm sorry. Once I'm gone, I'm gone. So I know what important it is to show up and get out of my thinking and help someone else. And this is a daily thing because I was a hard drinking, a hard drug user. But today, y'all, it's a week program. Y'all helped me stay alive. Thanks.
Anybody ask for a blue chip? Now I'm reconsidering a white chip. And then you changed your mind and come get this. Okay, we're going to leave it up here. Thank you for the chips you helped.
It's now time for any AA or NABA Club announcements. Who would like to start? Nobody? Mark?
My name is Mark, and I'm home.
Hey, Mark.
I have a key to the ministry cabinet. If anyone like an aid, excuse me, ask for me.
Anybody else? I have an announcement. Next Monday, May 23rd, Eric W. will be telling a story. Uh-huh. And then the following Monday, Midge G. will be telling her story. Okay. Let's see. I would like to remind everyone that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, please join us for the Lord's Prayer.
Thank you.